A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us. The story of two brothers, Charles and Augustus Storrs, unmarried Mansfield merchants who made their money in New York wholesaling and then, in 1881, turned around and donated 170 acres plus $5,000 to start an agricultural school in their hometown. He wants the full arc, who they were, the family roots, the mercantile career, why they gave the land, the school's rough early years, the evolution all the way to Yukon in 1939, and what that bet looks like 145 years later. Plus the moral act context, the silk industry collapse in Mansfield, the whole picture.
Oh, this is Corn. You know I grew up in Storrs. This is my backyard. I wandered that campus as a kid. Horse Barn Hill, the old agricultural buildings, the whole town built around a university that started with two bachelor brothers who never had kids of their own, but basically adopted an entire state's future.
I do know that. You've mentioned it, a few hundred times. But I'll admit, I never really knew the actual Storrs brothers. They're just a name on a town sign.
What a story. By the way, DeepSeek 5.4 Pro is writing our script today, so if I sound unusually coherent, credit the model.
Now, before you launch into the full walking encyclopedia mode, these Storrs brothers, you grew up there. Did you know their story as a kid, or is this something you picked up later?
Bits and pieces as a kid. The town takes the name seriously. There's a Storrs Historical Society, there are plaques, the old family homestead gets mentioned. But I really dug into it when I was older, and what's striking is how improbable the whole thing was. Two brothers who left Mansfield as young men built a successful wholesale business in New York, never married, and then in their 60s decided to essentially give away a chunk of their family land to create something that didn't exist yet.
Let's start with the family. Who were the Storrs clan in Mansfield before Charles and Augustus came along?
The Storrs family had deep roots in Mansfield. They were farming people, not wealthy, not prominent in any statewide sense, but established. The family had been in that part of Connecticut since the early 18th century. Mansfield itself was a rural town, rocky soil, hardscrabble farming. Not the kind of place you'd predict would one day host a flagship state university.
Rocky soil and hardscrabble farming. Sounds like half the towns in New England. What made Mansfield different?
That's the thing. For a while, it was silk. Mansfield became a center of the silk industry in the early to mid-19th century. Mulberry trees, silkworms, small-scale silk mills. The Cheney brothers over in Manchester get most of the historical attention, but Mansfield had its own silk economy, and then it collapsed. A combination of things. Competition from imported silk, disease hitting the mulberry trees, and a series of economic panics. By the 1870s, Mansfield's silk industry was basically gone. Farmers who had invested in mulberry orchards and silkworm cultivation were left with nothing. The town was economically devastated.
That's the backdrop. A town whose main industry just evaporated, farming families struggling, and two brothers who'd gotten out and made money elsewhere.
Charles Storrs was born in 1810, Augustus in 1817. They grew up on the family farm. Their father was a farmer, not a wealthy man, but respectable. The brothers were part of a large family, and like a lot of young men from rural New England in that era, they eventually left to seek their fortunes.
Where did they go?
New York City. They went into the wholesale mercantile trade, dry goods, commodities, the kind of business where you buy in bulk and sell to retailers. And they were successful. Not Vanderbilt-level successful, not the kind of wealth that gets your name in history books, but they built a solid, prosperous business. By the 1870s, they were comfortably well off, unmarried, and thinking about what to do with their money.
Unmarried? That's an interesting detail. Two bachelor brothers running a business together, no heirs. Was that unusual for the time?
Not as unusual as we might think. There were plenty of bachelor merchants in 19th century New York, but it does shape the story. They had no children to pass their wealth to, which may have made the idea of a philanthropic gift more natural. They also had a younger brother, Edmund Storrs, who stayed in Mansfield and kept the family farm going, so they maintained that connection to the town.
They're in their 60s, successful but not fabulously wealthy, no children, and they're watching their hometown struggle after the silk collapse. What actually prompted the donation?
There's a broader context here that we need to pull in. The Morrill Act of 1862. Have you heard of it?
Land-grant colleges, right?
The Morrill Act was signed by Lincoln during the Civil War. It gave each state federal land, 30,000 acres for each senator and representative, to sell and use the proceeds to establish colleges focused on agriculture and the mechanical arts. The idea was to make practical education accessible to the working classes, not just the elite who studied classics at places like Yale and Harvard.
Without excluding other scientific and classical studies, isn't that the phrase from the Act?
The Act specifically said the colleges should teach agriculture, engineering, and military tactics, but without excluding other scientific and classical studies. It was a revolutionary idea that a university education should serve practical needs, not just produce gentlemen. But Connecticut was slow to take advantage of it. Yale had a stranglehold on higher education in Connecticut. The state's elite didn't see the need for an agricultural college. Farmers' groups and grange organizations pushed for it throughout the 1870s, arguing that Connecticut's agriculture was falling behind. Outdated methods, soil depletion, no scientific approach to farming. The silk collapse in Mansfield made that argument urgent.
There's political pressure building. The Morrill Act money is sitting there, and Mansfield, with its collapsed silk industry and struggling farms, becomes the logical place to put an agricultural school.
And this is where Charles and Augustus enter the picture. In 1881, they offered to donate 170 acres of the old family farm, plus $5,000 in cash, to the state of Connecticut, on the condition that the state establish the Storrs Agricultural School on that land.
170 acres and $5,000. What's $5,000 in 1881 terms?
Roughly $150,000 today, maybe a bit more. Not a fortune, but enough to get things started. The land was the bigger gift. And the Connecticut General Assembly accepted the offer and chartered the Storrs Agricultural School that same year.
I want to pause on the brothers themselves for a moment. What do we actually know about Charles and Augustus as people? Were they involved in the school after the donation, or did they just write the check and walk away?
They stayed involved. Charles served as a trustee. They both took an active interest in the school's development, but they were old men by then. Charles was 71 when the school was chartered, Augustus was 64. Charles died in 1900, Augustus in 1892. They lived long enough to see the school get established, but not long enough to see it become anything like a real university.
What was the school actually like in those early years? You mentioned it was tortured.
Oh, it was rough. The Storrs Agricultural School opened in 1881 with a handful of students. I think the first class was something like a dozen young men. The curriculum was basic: farming techniques, some science, practical skills. It was essentially a trade school with academic aspirations. The facilities were primitive, the faculty was tiny, and there was constant political pressure from the state legislature about funding.
Who was running it?
The first principal was a man named Henry Phelps Armsby. He was a serious agricultural scientist, had studied at Yale and in Germany, which was the center of advanced agricultural research at the time. Armsby wanted to build a real scientific institution, but he was constantly fighting with the legislature over money. At one point, the school's annual appropriation was something like $8,000. That's for everything: salaries, buildings, equipment, everything.
$8,000 a year to run an entire college, even in 1881 dollars, that's absurd.
It was barely enough to keep the doors open. Armsby left after a few years, frustrated. The school went through a series of principals and presidents in those early decades, each one struggling with the same problems: not enough money, not enough students, and a state government that wasn't sure it wanted an agricultural college at all.
How did it survive?
And the fact that the Morrill Act framework gave it a legal reason to exist. Plus, the farmers' organizations kept pushing. The Connecticut Grange was a powerful political force, and they saw the school as their project. There was also a growing recognition, nationally, not just in Connecticut, that American agriculture needed to modernize. The 1870s and 80s were a period of intense agricultural depression in parts of the country. Soil exhaustion, falling prices, competition from the Midwest. Scientific farming wasn't just a nice idea, it was becoming an economic necessity.
Mansfield, with its field silk experiment, was a pretty vivid case study in what happens when you don't modernize.
The town had bet on silk and lost. The agricultural school was, in a sense, a bet on a different future, one based on science, experimentation, and training farmers to think systematically about what they were doing.
Walk me through the name changes. Storrs Agricultural School to Yukon. That's a lot of evolution.
It's a story in four acts. Act 1, Storrs Agricultural School, 1881. Small, struggling, focused entirely on practical agriculture. Act 2, in 1893, it became Storrs Agricultural College. The name change reflected a slightly broader mission. Still agricultural, but college implied a higher level of academic work. Act 3, in 1899, it became Connecticut Agricultural College. That was significant. The state name replaced the Storrs name in the institution's title. The Storrs Brothers Town kept their name, but the college was now officially a state institution.
The brothers themselves. Charles had died by then, right? Augustus even earlier.
Augustus died in 1892, Charles in 1900. So Charles lived just long enough to see the name change to Connecticut Agricultural College, barely. But neither of them saw what came next. The big transformation. In 1933, it became Connecticut State College. That reflected a major expansion. It was no longer just agriculture. They'd added liberal arts, sciences, education programs. It was becoming a comprehensive state college. And then, in 1939, the final step, the University of Connecticut.
1939. So from a dozen farm boys in 1881 to a full university in less than 60 years.
The growth really accelerated after World War II. The GI Bill sent enrollment soaring. The university added graduate programs, professional schools, a medical school later on. Today, UConn has something like 32,000 students across all its campuses. It's a major research university with a multi-billion dollar economic impact on the state.
The town, Storrs, Connecticut, is basically built around the university now.
It is the university. Storrs isn't an incorporated town, technically. It's a census-designated place within the town of Mansfield. But the name Storrs is what everyone knows. The main campus, the post office, the roads, it's all Storrs. Two bachelor brothers who never had children gave their name to a community of tens of thousands of students who've passed through over the decades.
Let me ask you something, since you grew up there. What did it feel like, as a kid, to live in a town that was named after two 19th century merchants?
You know, it's funny. When you're a kid, you don't think about it much. The name is just the name. But I remember walking across campus with my friends, past the old stone buildings, and every so often you'd see the name Storrs carved somewhere and think, oh right, actual people started this. Horse Barn Hill was my favorite spot. It's this big open hill on campus where they used to keep the agricultural school's animals. By the time I was a kid, it was mostly a place for sledding in winter and flying kites in summer. But you could still feel the agricultural roots of the place.
That's very Connecticut.
It's beautiful, actually. You can see for miles from the top. And it's still there, still part of the campus, still used by the agriculture students. There's something about that continuity that gets to me. The same hill where the first students learned soil management in the 1880s is still part of a working agricultural program.
Let's talk about the Morrill Act's broader legacy, because that's a huge part of this story. UConn isn't unique. There are land-grant universities all over the country.
More than 70 of them. The Morrill Act of 1862 created institutions like Michigan State, Penn State, Cornell, MIT, Purdue, Texas A&M, the list goes on. A second Morrill Act in 1890 added funding and required states to either admit black students to their land-grant colleges or establish separate institutions, which led to the historically black land-grant colleges. The whole system transformed American higher education.
It's one of those pieces of legislation that most people have never heard of, but it shaped the country in enormous ways.
Before the Morrill Act, American colleges were mostly private, mostly religious, and mostly focused on training clergy and gentlemen in the classics. The idea that a university should teach farmers and engineers, that it should be publicly funded, that practical knowledge was just as worthy as Latin and Greek. That was radical, and it worked. The land-grant universities produced the agricultural scientists, the engineers, the teachers who built the 20th century American economy.
The Storrs brothers were part of that wave, even if they probably didn't think of themselves that way. They were just two old men who wanted to help their hometown.
Which is what makes the story so human. They weren't visionaries in the sense of having some grand theory of education. They were successful merchants who'd done well and felt an obligation to the place they came from. Charles, in particular, seems to have been the driving force. He was the older brother, the one who served as a trustee. Augustus was more in the background.
What happened to their business after they died?
That's an interesting question, and honestly, I don't know the details. The wholesale business in New York presumably was sold or dissolved. Neither brother had children, so there was no one to inherit it. The money they'd made largely went into the school, one way or another. Charles's estate left additional funds to the college after his death.
They essentially gave everything to this institution.
And for the first couple of decades, it must have looked like a questionable investment. The school was tiny, underfunded, constantly on the brink of being shut down by the legislature. It didn't become coeducational until the 1890s. It took decades to build any kind of reputation. If you'd visited Storrs in 1890 and looked at that little agricultural school, you would not have predicted a flagship state university with a basketball program that wins national championships.
Right. The basketball. UConn's a powerhouse now. Men's and women's.
16 national championships between the two programs. The women's team under Gino Auriemma is arguably the greatest dynasty in college sports history. For a school that started as an agricultural experiment station, it's become synonymous with elite basketball.
Which is a pretty remarkable second act. The Storrs brothers probably never imagined that their little farming school would one day be on national television with millions of people watching.
They probably never imagined television, period. But there's something fitting about it. The land-grant mission was about serving the whole state, not just the elite. And sports, whatever you think of big-time college athletics, is one way a university connects with ordinary people. The UConn basketball programs have done more to build statewide pride and identity than any academic program ever could.
That's a fair point, though I suspect Charles and Augustus would be baffled by the whole spectacle.
They'd walk into Gamble Pavilion and have no idea what was happening. But I think they'd recognize the core idea, that this institution they helped create belongs to the people of Connecticut, and that it matters in their lives.
Let me circle back to something you mentioned earlier. The silk industry collapse in Mansfield. That feels like an underappreciated part of the story. Without that economic devastation, does the town fight so hard for the agricultural school?
Or at least the political will wouldn't have been as strong. Mansfield in the 1870s was a town that had tried to industrialize and failed. The soil was poor for traditional farming. The silk experiment had collapsed. The town needed a new economic identity. The agricultural school offered that, not just as an employer, but as a source of expertise that could help local farmers improve their practices.
The Morrill Act created the financial mechanism. Federal land grants sold off to fund the school.
Connecticut sold its Morrill Act land, mostly out west somewhere, and used the proceeds as an endowment. The Storrs brothers' donation provided the physical campus. The combination of federal policy, state politics, local economic desperation, and individual philanthropy is what made it happen.
What was the relationship like between the school and the town in those early years? Was there tension, or did everyone get along?
There was definitely tension. Some local farmers were skeptical of book farming, the idea that professors could tell them how to run their farms. Others resented the tax money going to the school. But over time, the relationship improved, especially as the school started producing graduates who could demonstrate practical results.
Who were the first cohort?
Mostly local farm boys, as I mentioned. The first class was tiny, maybe a dozen or so. They lived in a converted farmhouse. They worked on the school's experimental farm as part of their training. It was hands-on, practical, and not particularly glamorous. But for young men who couldn't afford Yale or Wesleyan, it was an opportunity.
Did the school charge tuition?
Initially, it was free for Connecticut residents, part of the land-grant mission of accessibility. That changed over time, but the principle of keeping costs low for in-state students has been part of UConn's identity from the beginning.
Let's fast forward to today, 145 years after the donation. What's the Stowers brothers' legacy, in concrete terms?
UConn is a billion-dollar-plus enterprise now. It's the largest public university in Connecticut, one of the top public research universities in the country, with campuses across the state. The main campus in Stowers employs thousands of people. The university's economic impact on Connecticut is enormous. Something like $5 billion a year, if you count direct spending, research funding, and the earnings of graduates who stay in the state.
The town of Stowers itself, what's it like now?
It's a college town through and through. About 15,000 permanent residents, plus the student population. The campus is the center of everything. There's a little downtown area with restaurants and shops, but the university dominates. It's quiet in the summer when students leave, and packed during the academic year. Horse Barn Hill is still there. The old stone dairy barn is a landmark. The whole place has a kind of gentle, rural academic feel that's very New England.
You sound nostalgic.
Stowers shaped me. Growing up there, wandering the campus, going to basketball games, sledding on Horse Barn Hill, it gave me a sense of what a university could be. A place that belongs to everyone. A place that started with a gift from two old men who wanted to do right by their hometown.
You know, you've never really talked about what you did after you left Stowers. You mentioned international consulting. That's pretty vague.
It was consulting. Nothing mysterious about it.
Consulting for whom? You got all these stories about traveling the world, but you never actually specify what you were doing.
I helped organizations with strategic planning, cross-border operations, that sort of thing.
That's the most spy-adjacent description I've ever heard. Cross-border operations. Were you a spy, Herman?
I was not a spy. I was a consultant.
That's exactly what a spy would say.
Korn, I was a pediatrician before I went into consulting. Spies don't typically do a decade-plus in pediatric medicine as cover.
That would be excellent cover, actually. Nobody suspects the pediatrician.
I'm going to move us back to the Stowers brothers now, if you don't mind.
But I'm filing this under unresolved.
The point I was making is that growing up in a town named after philanthropists, seeing what a gift like that can become over a century, it sticks with you. Charles and Augustus Stowers couldn't have imagined UConn in 2026. But they planted the seed, and that's worth remembering.
Two bachelor merchants who never married, never had children, and essentially adopted an entire state's future. There's something quietly moving about that.
And here's what I think gets overlooked in a lot of these institutional histories. The Stowers brothers weren't exceptional. They were successful, yes, but they weren't titans of industry. They weren't famous. They were just two people who had more than they needed and decided to give it back in a way that was tied to a specific place and a specific community.
The specificity matters. They didn't give money to some abstract cause. They gave land, their family's land, to create something in their hometown.
And that land carried meaning. The Stowers family had farmed it for generations. Charles and Augustus grew up on it. When they donated those 170 acres, they were giving away a piece of their own history.
Do we know where the original farmhouse was?
It's not standing anymore, but the site is on the UConn campus. There's a marker, I believe. The university has done a decent job of preserving the historical memory of the brothers, even though most students probably walk past without noticing.
Most students everywhere walk past historical markers without noticing. That's practically a law of nature.
But every so often, someone stops and reads, and the story gets passed on. That's how these things work.
All right, let's zoom out for a moment. What's the big takeaway from the Stowers story, beyond the local history?
I think it's about the multiplier effect of public investment in education. The Stowers brothers gave 170 acres and $5,000. The Morrill Act provided the framework and some initial funding. The state of Connecticut, grudgingly at first, then more enthusiastically, kept the institution alive. And 145 years later, that initial gift has multiplied into an institution that educates tens of thousands of students a year, conducts billions of dollars in research, and anchors an entire region's economy.
It's a pretty good return on investment.
It's an astonishing return on investment. And it's not just economic. Think about the lives changed. The first-generation college students, the kids from working-class families who got an education they never would have had otherwise, the research breakthroughs in agriculture, health sciences, engineering, the cultural impact, the artists, the teachers, the nurses, the engineers who came out of UConn and went on to do important things. You can't quantify all of that.
It started with two old men and a farm.
It started with two old men and a farm.
I want to ask you one more thing about the moral act context, because I think it's easy to miss how radical it was. You mentioned that the act was signed during the Civil War. That's a striking detail. The country is literally tearing itself apart, and Congress is passing legislation to create agricultural colleges.
It's one of the most remarkable things about the Civil War period. While the Union was fighting for its survival, the Republican Congress was passing a series of transformative laws. The Homestead Act, the Pacific Railway Act, the Morrill Act. They were building the institutional foundations of the post-war economy even as the war was still being fought. Justin Morrill, the Vermont congressman who sponsored the act, had been pushing for it since the 1850s. It had actually passed Congress earlier, but was vetoed by President Buchanan. Lincoln signed it in 1862.
It almost didn't happen. If Buchanan had signed the earlier version, or if the Civil War had gone differently...
The counterfactuals are endless. But the point is, it did happen, and it created a system that transformed American higher education. The Storrs Agricultural School was a tiny piece of that system, but it grew into something significant.
Let's bring it back to Mansfield for a moment. You mentioned the silk industry collapse as the crisis that created political urgency. Was there anyone else in the state pushing for an agricultural college, or was it mostly the Mansfield delegation?
It was broader than just Mansfield. The Connecticut Grange and other farmers' organizations had been lobbying for years. There were proposals to locate the agricultural college in other towns. Some people wanted it closer to Hartford, others suggested New Haven. Mansfield won out partly because of the Storrs brothers' offer, and partly because the town's economic situation made it a sympathetic case.
The donation wasn't just generous, it was strategically timed.
Very much so. Charles and Augustus knew what they were doing. They'd been watching the agricultural college debate in the state legislature. They understood that a land donation plus cash would make Mansfield an attractive choice. They were merchants. They understood negotiation and timing.
That's an important point. They weren't just sentimental old men giving away the family farm. They were savvy businessmen making a calculated philanthropic investment.
And that makes the story more interesting, not less. They used their business skills to craft a gift that would have maximum impact. The conditions they attached, that the school be located on their land and bear their name, ensured that their legacy would be tied to the institution's success.
The name mattered to them.
And it worked. 145 years later, we're still saying their name.
All right. Herman, final thoughts. You grew up in Storrs. You left for your mysterious international consulting career. What does this story mean to you personally?
It means that places shape people in ways they don't always recognize at the time. Growing up in a town named after philanthropists, on a campus built on donated land, surrounded by the idea that education is a public good that sinks in. I didn't think about it much as a kid, but looking back, I can see how it formed me. The idea that you give back, that institutions matter, that a small gift can grow into something enormous over time.
That's genuinely lovely, even if you were a spy.
I was not a spy. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a marine biologist working in Patagonia discovered that a single species of nudibranch, a type of sea slug, produces a chemical compound in its skin that is chemically identical to a defensive toxin previously known only from a single species of Antarctic sponge. The two organisms have not shared a common ancestor in over 500 million years, making this one of the most extreme cases of convergent chemical evolution ever documented in a single surviving artifact, a frozen tissue sample that still sits in a university freezer in Punta Arenas.
Right. A frozen sea slug in Patagonia.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Thanks for listening.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear hose. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.